Welcome to Cyber Focus from the McCrary Institute, where we explore the people and ideas shaping and defending our digital world. I'm your host, Frank Salufo, and have the privilege today to sit down with Anjana Rajan. Anjana is the Assistant National Cyber Director for Technology Security at the Office of the National Cyber Director in the White House. Prior to joining the White House, she was at Polaris, the largest NGO combating human trafficking. Prior to that, was at an NGO combating and helping survivors and victims of sexual assaults. So Technology for Good comes to this issue with a background in cryptology as well as an engineer. I might note one other important factor on her bio, and that is that she was an athlete, competed for Team USA as a triathlete for many years. And I bring that up not only because it's pretty badass and cool, but also because I think there are two key characteristics that are essential to anyone working in big policy issues in DC: endurance and persistence. All you hear about is when a big issue is promulgated and things are signed, but let me tell you, there's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears that goes behind getting a concept to reality, and especially at the White House. Anjana, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
Really excited. I hope you'll be able to go into some depth around a technical report that the Office of the National Cyber Director released, and obviously you played an essential role in getting from idea to reality, and that's back to the building blocks, and it's an emphasis on software. So rather than me stealing any of the thunder here, why don't you please jump in?
As you know, the Office of the National Cyber Director is probably best known for writing the President's National Cybersecurity Strategy. And in the year since it was published, there were a couple of artifacts that came out of that. First was the implementation plan, which was really speaking to the federal government about how do we take these big ideas and move them forward. Then we had the National Workforce and Education Strategy, which was really talking to employers and educators on how to build the supply of the workforce and the talent to meet this moment. And so the third chapter of this trilogy is really speaking to the technical community, and that's what Back to the Building Blocks really set out to do.
Awesome, awesome. And if you could paint a picture for what is in the report, why it matters, and hopefully we'll have time to where we go from here. So
I think to set the scene in a very big picture, if we were to approach any of the other battle domains the way we approach cybersecurity, it would be untenable. It would be like we're waiting for the bomb to drop and then we raise a white flag and then we do a retro and figure out how to move forward. And that's what we're doing right now. And the bad news about cyberspace is it's changing every single day. Every time we think we get to understand the arena, it changes on us and we have to adapt. But that dynamism is actually to our advantage. We can actually remove and re-engineer the topography to serve our advantage. And so it becomes a reframing of the problem around what does it mean to be an engineer in cybersecurity, and how do we think about architecting the battlefield to our national interests. And one of the things we observed was we have taken the lessons from these other battle domains on how we think about security. We really are taking a what we call a perimeter in approach. We're trying to identify where the boundary is. We're trying to erect walls and fences and guard posts to make sure that no one can come in. And then we monitor and alert our ways to see where the adversaries are. But there is no coastline in cyberspace. And we see that with supply chain attacks and insider threats and social engineering. And we have to rethink this perimeter in approach. It's not working sufficiently. And so our kind of the thesis of the report is that we need to treat this not as a risk management problem alone, but rather as an architecture problem. And we need to reimagine what are the raw materials of cyberspace, what are the building blocks that we're using to create our technologies, and really ensure that they're higher quality and more secure so that we're architecting forward. And so that was really the big idea and the big paradigm shift with the paper. I think as we think about what are the two big problems that policymakers are faced with, one is how do we get the private sector to patch known vulnerabilities? And that's a hard problem because patching software is complicated. The incentives are not always aligned. And so much of the administration's work to date, including the executive order 14028, is really about raising the bar of compliance to make sure that we're only as strong as our weakest link. But the second hard problem, in which ONCD has been really focused on, is, okay, but what happens if even if you meet those compliance measures? There are many 0 days just sitting and waiting to be exploited, even if you do all the right things, because we can't predict and detect these vulnerabilities around the corner. And so that became like the core thesis and the core question, which is how do you get ahead of the threat? Mm-hmm. And the thesis of the report, again, looking at it from an engineer's point of view, is really offers two very kind of broad solutions, and I'll talk about each mm-hmm. of them. But the first one says that you have to get ahead of your threat by shrinking the surface area mm-hmm. that the adversary has to play with. And right now, it's like the net is just so big. They're just scoring layups.
Bigger and bigger and
yeah,
bigger.
They're scoring
IoT,
very easy points against us. Yeah. They're not having to try very hard. And so if we can really focus our energy on reducing that surface area, mm-hmm. making it smaller, not only does it reduce the likelihood of an attack, but it also creates a form of deterrence that they're going to be like, that's not exactly where we're going to put our resources. And so the way you shrink that surface area is by, instead of waiting for the bugs to be exploited and patching them retroactively, afterwards, you eliminate entire classes of bugs from the product before it gets shipped. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of seemingly simple idea is
easier said than done, though, right?
Yeah. Done. And we decided to focus on one class of vulnerability mm-hmm. To start with, to narrow our focus. And that first class of bugs that we're choosing to focus on is what we call memory safety vulnerabilities. Mm-hmm. And memory safety vulnerabilities, simply put, is just a type of bug that allows a malicious actor to exploit how data is stored both spatially and temporally. And there's so many different types. There's a handful of different memory safety bugs that have plagued us for the last several decades. And what's interesting is when we look at all the headlines from the last 50 years, mm-hmm. we look at the very first computer worm from 1988, you look at the Morris worm mm-hmm. or the Slimer worm attack in 2003 or even WannaCry, which was 2017, mm-hmm. to the BlastPass exploit that happened just last fall. What it turns out is that when you look at the root cause of each of those ransomware attacks and other types of vulnerabilities, the root cause were all coming from the same class of bug. Mm-hmm. They all mm-hmm. came from a memory safety vulnerability. And that was an insight that we wanted to bring to the policymaking world's attention, which is the kind of the after-action review is leading us to this one core problem. And what it turns out is that when you actually look at the reported number of CVEs that we have, up to 70% of our known CVEs are stemming from memory safety. So to us, there was both like a really urgent
bang for the buck,
big bang for your buck, and yeah. there was clearly an opportunity here to focus on this, because if we can figure this out, the reward is worth the effort. The reason this became very politically opportunistic is this was an opportunity where the technology was ripe and mm-hmm. ready for adoption. And one of the things that we noticed, particularly on the software side, was that you can actually get ahead of this by simply using what we call a memory safe programming language. Mm-hmm. And the reason this was interesting to us from a building block perspective is when you think of the most atomic unit of software, it's code. It's the language in which code is written. And if that language is not memory safe, mm-hmm. then nothing you write in that language is going to be memory safe. And so when we looked at what was going on, we said most engineers want to write in memory safe programming languages. It's very popular and very cool these days mm-hmm. to write in Rust and Python and JavaScript and Go, as opposed to these two main memory unsafe languages. And so we felt that there was a kind of a political opportunity to do something that was very well endorsed by engineers, mm-hmm. which is endorsing the languages that they want to write in mm-hmm. anyway. Mm-hmm. And so we really wanted to take this engineering forward approach and say, look, this is not about more regulation or more compliance documentation. It's really about endorsing better engineering practices. And we saw that was, we started with the open source software community to say, how do you feel about this? And we were really taken aback that there was a lot of endorsement of this. And so we said, okay, that might be an interesting building block to start with.
And taking a big set of issues from policy into practice, yeah. that's what it's all about at the end of the
yeah.
day. And I think this also aligns very well and quite honestly foot stomps a couple of the key priorities that came out of the
exactly,
National Cyber
yeah.
Strategy. And that was to shift some of the burden away from end users to entities that can grapple with it, or
yeah.
to shift it far left of the clickety-clack of the keyboard yeah. and the click and the boom and everything
yeah.
else, where else but software to start.
Exactly. And I think this is where I think as policymakers, it's like we're always starting at the edge and like the most complex. We're starting so downstream, and of course that's overwhelming and seemingly impossible. And when it turns out you actually shift left and go upstream and you go to the atomic unit, you go to the building block, it becomes a much more tractable problem. And so when you think about, okay, secure by design is a broad term for preventative work. Mm-hmm. But if you can say, look, software, there's hardware, there's firmware in between. If you can figure out those kind of core components, like you've covered quite a big surface area. So that was the first element, which is if you can start there and treat this as an architecture problem, as a manufacturing problem, now you're actually you're getting the CEO's attention, you're getting the CTO's attention, and you're not putting the onus just on the consumer's CISO, who is arguably...
But you're also focused on a community that can galvanize and get things done, right? So that's what's exciting.
I think so. It's somewhat intuitive being an engineer and having been a CTO that, like, this is a technical
field.
Should be
that way, but it's not always.
It's not always seen as a technical field.
Yeah.
And I think we want to show that the way you get the critical infrastructure and the national security system's attention is fundamentally by becoming technical with them and showing that you understand their mission, understand the complexity of the work they're doing. And I think as cybersecurity policymakers, we should not forget that fundamentally we are rooted in science and engineering and technology.
And one of the other, just because you brought up secure by design, I have to put in a footnote and a foot stomp for cyber-informed engineering as well. Similar sort of concept.
Exactly.
The whole idea is to get well before it becomes a problem. And where do we go from here?
So it's interesting because we started this work when I first joined ONCD, and this was in 2022, announced our work on promoting memory-safe languages probably in February of 2023 before the National Cybersecurity Strategy came out. The strategy did come out. There was a nice little Easter egg that talked about memory safety for those who were noticing. And it could have been very easy to say, okay, now let the policy work move forward in there. But I think for us, what we realized was important was, did we have policy market fit? Is this technically viable? And at the time, somewhat separately, ONCD was leading our work on space system cybersecurity, which I was part of, obviously, in the response to...
You own a lot of those issues, and I promise you we'll bring you back at some point
small,
to talk space.
Very small, narrow scope portfolio, just space and other things. But we were, obviously, it was important from a national security perspective, given the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, starting with the cyber attack on an American commercial satellite company. This was of very high importance to not just ONCD, but the administration at large. And as part of that work, we had embarked on a nationwide roadshow to the kind of big hubs, the five main cities in the country focus on space, including Los Angeles, obviously here in Northern Virginia, Washington, D.C., Cape Canaveral, Colorado Springs, and Houston. And as we embarked on these five cities, we would hold these technical workshops to talk about the concepts of secure by design in space. And we would convene up to 300 different aerospace and technical engineers from about 125 different space companies to talk about this. And during this conversation, the topic of memory-safe programming languages came up. And I remember in the room, like, all the computer scientists thought it was great. They're like, that sounds amazing. Like, we love that. But then all the mechanical engineers and aerospace engineers were, like, so angry at me because they were like, you have no idea what you're talking about. You have no idea how hard our mission is. You have no idea how hard it is to build hardware. And so it got a little, in the best way possible, it got like heated. And we were just really curious as to why they were this animated. And it wasn't because these were just, incumbent, didn't want to change. It wasn't actually that. There was something really interesting about what we learned from them, which was like there was a real physics constraint here. There was a real challenge in the science of like, how do you actually rewrite code for a satellite in orbit. It's not that easy. And we worked closely with our colleagues at NASA and JPL, who were very generous with educating me, at least, on the science of it. And it turns out it's really hard when you're dealing with what we call the cyber-physical nexus. And as you said, like where the hardware and software intersect, that firmware. Because when you write code and there's an action in the real world, the way you write code is very different than if you were writing code and something changes in
the
digital world.
Yeah.
And as a
software legacy
engineer,
systems
oh,
too,
absolutely.
Obviously.
And so for me as a software engineer, it was humbling to realize that there was a whole other type of technical element here that I had not been thinking about. And what we realized was as we were talking about, while there was alignment and agreement that memory safe outcomes were absolutely the way to go, And that, sure, when it comes to ground systems and enterprise systems for space ecosystem, sure, like we can move to memory-safe languages. There was a real element that we were missing in our thesis around, well, what about the hardware that's not literally on this planet?
Yep.
And it turns out there's a lot of constraints in what it means to write code in space. And when we learned what those are, you need something that's what we call close to the metal. It needs to be able to control like the kernel of the operating system. And you need to be able to really have these like deterministic precise outcomes that are like hyper precise with the timing, which again in space time
clocks
is a very,
rule the world.
Time and space is like, a little bit complicated. And then finally, you need to be able to override or eliminate the need of what we call a garbage collector, which in programming languages is that function that essentially is like the Roomba that just like cleans up like leftover data that's
great
being.
Yeah.
So you want to override that. And it turns out that the only real languages to date that have been able to meet those constraints were the two very memory unsafe languages we had been talking about. So there was this aha moment for us, which was, okay, how do we rethink our thesis? This isn't about us saying as a White House, you got to use this one language. That's not what we're saying. It's us saying, look, we want to get to this outcome.
This outcome.
We want to eliminate, we want to reduce the surface area. We want to eliminate this class of bugs. How do we get there? And that's when our thesis and in the report really evolved to say, building blocks is a construct, and there are three types of building blocks that we think can exist. One is a software base, which again is things like the programming language. But then there could be a hardware building block. So we said, okay, what are other ways to think about memory-safe outcomes when we look at the chip? Can we architect the chip and the semiconductor to handle memory safety in a more innovative way? And it turns out there's a lot of great R&D happening in that. And then the third piece is the mathematical reasoning. So this is where we introduce the idea of something called formal methods, which basically says, instead of testing my software to prove that it's an absence of a bug, can I actually prove affirmatively?
It's proving double negatives as opposed
to. Any engineer will tell you it's like impossible to finish testing every single permutation of and combination of scenario that would create a malfunction. But can you actually say, I want to prove that there are no buffer overflows. I want to prove that there isn't these types of bugs and or these types of negative outcomes. I can write literally a math proof, which we call formal methods, to get there. And this is something that many scientists and mathematicians have been thinking about for decades and has been used to apply that. It's been applied in national security systems to talk about functionality. But now we're saying, what if we brought that same way of thinking to security? And so this was really, and again, I'm really grateful for the public-private partnerships here, because with that education we got from the community, we were able to really evolve our thesis, and that was really what was reflected in that report.
And it's not every day that a White House office would go this deep into some of the technical issues. I have to say, I hope this is the first of many. Obviously, we have to get it over the goal line, and there's much to do. But
I think cybersecurity is such a multidisciplinary field, right?
By like definition, it's a team sport.
Totally, and I think part of ONCD's success, I think, is I've had to learn like non-technical skills, like how does policy get made? How does the law work?
Oh, and among other things. It's not a science, I can tell you that.
I think what's the beauty of it is how do you, bring a technical point of view, combine it with understanding how the budgeting process works, understanding how the policy and legislative process works, understanding how the intel community thinks and all these other things. And that's really the ethos of ONCD is that you see the way the directorates are designed is that we're all one spoke of a wheel that's coming together. And so our goal is to really say, look, we are coming here with the technical lens. It's agnostic to any mission space, but we have picked a few that we've chosen to start with. But we're starting to see the rest of ONCD take this idea and apply it to other interesting things within the national cybersecurity strategy. But it goes back to saying we all can wrap our heads around shift left. We can all think about this idea of like secure by design. I think the hard question is like, what does that technically mean?
What does it actually mean? And truth is, perimeter, there is no perimeter anymore. If you ask me, if you look at it, government tends to look at the world through its own boxes and org charts, not necessarily the messiness that is out there in the world.
Yeah.
But you bring a little bit of science and you can move the needle.
Yeah.
And where is the community now? What do you hope to see to translate this even further?
Yeah. I think there's going back to the space example, right? It was, if you look back where we were last summer and where we were with launch, it's been an amazing, they've been an amazing partner for us in this kind of storytelling. And in the report, space is the key case study we focus on for obvious reasons. But I think one of the main takeaways for us was, and this applies to not just space, but a lot of OT and a lot of critical infrastructure and national security systems, is when you think about the intersection of hardware and software, you have to recognize that we as cybersecurity professionals have to have humility for the mission, right? The mission isn't actually memory safety.
Or the product, even for that matter.
Yeah, the mission is I need to serve this military mission. I need to make sure that the troops on the ground have the right satellite imagery to know what they're walking into. I need to make sure that our nuclear weapons systems are secure. I need to make sure that our water is clean. These are the missions, right? Mm-hmm. And the analogy I always talk about is coming out of the summer of traveling at the space workshops is we think of ourselves as computer scientists and as software engineers. We're often like the figure skaters. We can sit and talk about the intricacies of how we skate and like people's eyes will glaze over. And we can talk about programming languages all day long. And when you talk to someone who's responsible for like hardware in particular, they're like the hockey player. Mm-hmm. They're like, I've got to get the puck in the goal. Mm-hmm. Like, nobody cares how I'm skating if I'm getting that done. And what we have to figure out is, how do we convince the mission control operator that skating better is actually going to help their mission? And I think that is where we as the cybersecurity field have our work cut out for us. And I think why it's important for us to be more technical is that if you want to get a NASA engineer to take you seriously, they need to know that you've done the work to understand.
And their headaches, right?
Yeah.
I mean, at the end of the day, you have to recognize that you recognize their big problems.
Exactly. So that's just the first half of the paper. The first half of the paper is really talking about taking these different building blocks approach. What does it mean to do hardware, software, math? And we put forward these three approaches. Mm-hmm. And there's some really exciting progress happening on that front within the U.S. government. But the second chapter is taking more of a longer-term view, which says that if we want to get ahead of our adversary, in addition to shrinking the surface area, we also have to better see the threat around the corner. We have to have better diagnostics. We have to understand our software better. We have to be able to measure it better. We just don't know. If you want to ask your software, hey, is there malware in this? Which is not a crazy question to be able to want to answer.
Especially today,
like, that is not a question you can ask very easily. Mm-hmm. It is very hard. And so we've built an ecosystem that is creating these like proxy questions. We're asking like, hey, are there any known CVEs in your code? Are there any bad hygiene that you're doing? But there's not a good way of actually asking like a precise question. The way to think about it is, to make an analogy, it's like we have thermometers and stethoscopes, which are like fine, can help detect whether you have a cold, but we don't have an MRI, we don't have an x-ray machine to detect if you have any really serious chronic illness. And so that limits us. And so our inability to even just understand our software poses like probably the biggest, in my opinion, like R&D challenge facing us.
By the way, not to pull that analogy further, but cybersecurity is very much like the emergency room model.
Oh, 100%.
Not preventative
health
in any way, shape, or form.
We are
literally
ER doctors. Yeah. And this goes back to the perimeter in and the building block out approach.
Absolutely.
Like, we can, in any complex systems work, you always need incident response, and you're going to always have that. But if you overstress the incident response, it becomes untenable.
It's the only way.
Right.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So this idea of what does prevention mean, there's a lot of ways to think about it. There's economic levers, there's policy levers. But there's also just a fundamentally hard technical question. What does it mean to re-engineer things?
What's
more
the
securely?
Sprinkler equivalent?
Yeah,
for
like
cyber.
It's hard. The question is, why is the market failing, so to speak, in cybersecurity? And like a lot of people, and I know we've talked about this, might argue it's because the private sector just doesn't care about cybersecurity and we should. And look, I come from the private sector and I personally don't think that's true. I don't think that there is any CTO or any CEO that is waking up every day and like going out of their way to say, let me like make our nation less
less
secure. No one is saying that. I can tell you that nobody wants to be the headline of a cyber breach. I do think that it's not a priority because they don't know what questions to ask, and they don't know how to tell if what their decisions are making are helping or harming the national interest.
And unfortunately, in this space, there's not a whole lot of love for coming in second, third, or fourth place, though, right?
Yeah.
In the software in general.
Yeah, and if you were to say that to them, like, how are you making purchasing decisions of your software? Right now, look for a certification or ask for a thing, but there's not a real rooted understanding or a way to make that a value proposition right now. And that comes back to the root cause, which is there's information gap in cybersecurity.
But you did identify some levers in the report.
Yeah.
You want to shed a little bit of light on that?
Because
if you think about it, not to go far down the analogy, but would we fly planes would we drive cars? Would we go on boats that if they were done the same way some of our software is designed right now? I think there is a demand
there
for
safety. There is. Oh, absolutely.
I think you're finding some of those levers.
And
right?
So when we were writing this, we were like, why aren't we, naively, we were like, why don't we just have a metric that's like. Mm-hmm.
And that's a great starting point.
We,
you got to measure something.
We said this like very naively. I was like, and I like wrote an equation that was like very overly simplistic. And we're like, this is it. This is how we measure cybersecurity
Simple
quality.
Normally
and
is best, though.
It turns out when you talk to the people who've been spending like their whole career thinking about it, the reason it's like it was naive for me to say that is because like it's really hard to measure software, and it's hard for three reasons. It's hard because number one, code is like a form of human expression. It's like poetry. It's like the way I would write a program is not going to be the same the way you write a program. So there isn't like
luckily for you
there's not like a clear set of rules of how you do this. Second, it's not always like deterministic. It's not always going to do the same thing, so you can't really evaluate it in the same way. And then third, it's code itself is really hard to analyze. And this has been a problem studied by mathematicians and scientists for decades. And so we had to have this moment of before we just like naively call for, glibly for a metric and make every scientist roll their eyes at me, it was a realizing that, there's a research gap. We need a scientific breakthrough on how to do measurement, on how to do understanding. And that was really what we realized that our power as the White House was to, again, go say, look, if this is a multi-decade problem and we have the power sitting at the White House to draw attention to what we believe is the most urgent emerging technology problem, the most interesting like cyber hard problem, so to speak, we want to say it loudly that it's software understanding and software measurability and metrology is the most important research field. And then if we make breakthroughs in that, then we can start to see, you know, how this actually shifts the market. And what we do have clarity on now is that we can say that there are multiple dimensions to measure software. You have the development process itself, like how is code written? There's the software assurance, like how does the product actually operate? And then the third is the execution environment, like where is this being deployed? And if you can create understanding of how to measure and understand across those three dimensions, then you've got a fairly full picture of what it means to deploy software.
And at least you start measuring what matters. At least you know what you're measuring.
And so in somewhat of
the integers, at least.
And somewhat of a meta point, we're saying we need to make work on the research side, on the science side, to get to this point where we have this metric. And yes, once we have these metrics, like then you can do some interesting things. You can start watching the market shift. You can start seeing how the difference between a CTO, a CIO, and a CISO, and how they collectively are going to be accountable for the cybersecurity of an ecosystem, and they're going to make manufacturing choices differently, they're going to make purchasing decisions differently, they're going to configure and create an execution environment differently. And that's how you start to see the market respond to this. And that is our thesis, that the market failure is coming from a scientific gap, and that before we can actually start penalizing people for not knowing, for not doing things, like we don't even know what we're doing. And that was the main thing. And so to your question earlier of what's happened since we launched, one exciting kind of news that we are able to share today is this urgent desire to see the understanding of software. We are not alone in that. We are share that same urgency is something that our friends working at Sandia National Labs
doing some phenomenal work
has been thinking about for a long time. And as they are dealing with a very important and very complex mission around our nuclear weapons security and our national systems security. And their work, they've created a program called SUNS, which stands for Software Understanding of National Systems, that we are working in close partnership with to say, how do we now convene and bring the national security apparatus to understand this emerging technology problem? How do we tie that to the work of the building blocks with formal methods that can help us actually understand it better? So we've also been able to say that since the report has launched, our colleagues at DARPA have just launched a new program called Provers, which is really about how do you democratize formal methods and make that a something that is accessible, not just to advanced mathematicians, but to the everyday engineer. And so there's a lot of really exciting progress happening across the government right now on both of those sides. And there's a lot more to come that we're excited to talk about.
And tapping to mobilize and galvanize, most engineers just want to get to a solution, right? They want to fix things. So if they know where they can be, and part of that, though, gets to, and you mentioned this in different sorts of ways in terms of decisions being made in boardrooms and some of the C-suite sorts of issues. It can't just be push down to either the software engineer or even the CISO in many respects.
Totally,
or the CISO needs to have visibility as part of the overall risk of a firm, right?
And this goes back to, I think, what you were saying earlier, which is if you are going to treat cybersecurity forever as a risk management tactic, as a compliance tactic, it is a race to the floor.
Mm-hmm.
It will always be seen as, okay, what is the bare minimum I can do? It will never be a CEO priority.
Mm-hmm.
It will certainly not be a boardroom priority, because the CEO's job is not to sit and think about the incident response. It's not, they have harder things to think about. Their job is to think about innovation and going to market faster and succeeding economically.
Mm-hmm.
So it is, again, if you want this to become, if you want the markets to shift, as cybersecurity professionals and as policymakers, the ideas we need to come up with have to appeal to that mission.
And align.
And I think for us, this is what's why Building Blocks is resonating with a lot of CEOs right now, is because we're selling them on an idea that is fundamentally different than what they've heard over the last two decades.
Mm-hmm.
They're hearing that secure building blocks is going to make their product better. It's going to make their market share bigger. It's going to allow them to go to market faster. It's going to cut down their costs of on the back end. It's all these other things that we're promoting to them that says, you want to build a good quality product.
Mm-hmm.
Cybersecurity is a quality imperative. It is not just a constraint that you tack on at the end. And I think this, again, goes back to what are we doing to define our field, which is still a very young field, fundamentally as one of, yes, national security importance, but also economic growth. And I think that's the next phase for us, which is, okay, I think we've successfully convinced everybody in this report that memory safety, for example, is a national security imperative. What's next for us in this implementation is, can I also show you that it is a better developer experience?
Absolutely.
It's also going to make your product better. It's going to get you more market share. And I think we are... things are heading in that direction.
I think we're hitting that tipping point. That would be
so,
pretty
awesome.
Because the truth is, we do need to build a business case.
Yeah.
And we can't see it as an either-or proposition,
100%,
which it's been treated as for so long. The truth is, one enables, or can, done right, enable the
and
other.
And this is what we talk about in the strategy, going back to the North Star, right? It's about, if we are not thinking about the affirmative vision, like what is the cyberspace that we want to live in, we want to build, then we're always going to be reacting to what our adversaries are. They're going to set the agenda.
Absolutely. And we've got to shift that
as
much as we can, without a doubt. This is amazing work. I really hope you do get to that tipping point. Any other big tech challenges you're hopefully going to, because in addition to the what and the why, I think, is pretty consistent here. The how, you did do this in a very collaborative kind of way, and it brought not just the cyber community, but it brought engineers, it brought software engineers and others into this fight. Anything else we can be waiting for?
I think this is hopefully
this is enough for we need a moonshot-like equivalent here,
right? I think, just to talk a bit about how we built this, right? I think oftentimes people are skeptical of the government's willingness to engage with the private sector. And it's often a round table here, but then it's okay, now what? But I think for us, again, I'm very obsessed with product market fit as like a construct, right? Like that feel, like when you build a product in the private sector and your customer loves it, it is the most addictive feeling, right? So how do you bring that to the, how do you bring that ethos to policymaking? And we treated this report like we treated building like an engineering product, which was like, how do we get conviction on a thesis? How do we iterate on it with stakeholders and users?
You have a formal scrum process?
But we were writing really fast, right?
Cool.
Like we put out 12 drafts of this report. My teammates and
12.
I were, it was a lot. And I think we, like I said, originally, like the initial thesis of the report was wrong. We were like, let's just talk about memory safe languages. And then it turns out like there's not policy market fit there.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out when you talk to the space industry, you're not getting it. So you have to go back to the drawing board and say, okay, am I open minded enough to rethink what I'm pushing?
Mm-hmm.
Similarly with the software understanding piece, originally it was like, here's the math, like here's what the equation should be. And it was like, whoa, it's actually something harder. So we revisited and redesigned the product essentially. But I think a lot
which
of people
is
were.
Which is important to be able to question your assumptions and then readjust and pivot.
And I think a lot of people also were like, why is it's just a humble technical report, right? It's not an executive order, it's not a draft regulation.
I would argue we need more humble technical.
And so I think it is tempting to want to jump to the saying, well, I want to write like this very fancy thing. And for us, we realized that, look, I'm sure there will be executive orders and regulation and policy that will build off this document in the future. But I think there was something about the White House coming out and talking about something that like often doesn't get talked about, like programming languages, showing that to the technical community that like, hey, when you start seeing like a more heavy-handed approach, like here's our work. Let me show you how we got here. That trust building, I think, is so critical. And I think what we are, it's not capital P policy, like there's nothing legally binding about this technology, but we do refer to it as doctrine, right? In the sense that it is offering.
It touches everything, where literally any of the critical infrastructures
and functions.
And it's
offering a new way of thinking that I think people are going to see things differently. I was reading just recently, there was an article, I think, in TechCrunch that was talking about how the venture market for cybersecurity is decreasing. Mm-hmm. And that there's all these highly valued cyber companies that were valued at like over $1 billion that are now being like sold for parts at an order of magnitude less. And so it raises an interesting question because it's like, why is that happening? It's not because the threat is going away.
Mm-hmm.
It's not because the demand is not there. Like the demand is higher than ever. The threat is higher than ever.
Absolutely.
It's because we don't have product market fit. It's because it's not working and that businesses are not seeing the value of the money they're spending and that they're scratching their head saying, like, I can't keep paying for this perimeter
and approach. Over and over and expecting a different outcome.
Yeah, this perimeter and approach is not working. And again, I look at that as like validation of, yeah, let's try this. Let's get product market fit. Let's get policy market fit. And let's see if it's working. And if it does, then we have clarity on, okay, what are then the policy levers? Do we need, how do we enforce this? Yeah, then we talk about regulation. Then we talk about procurement. We talk about all these things, but we have to remember that this is quite literally like a very hard science problem.
Absolutely.
You know, and we understand if we're trying to end cancer, we don't just start with the regulation first. We start with the science first.
Absolutely.
And I think that has to be applied.
It's the way it should
to
be.
Our field.
Let me ask, do you envision a day where, so there's some innovative policies coming out like the trust mark and labeling.
Yeah.
Do you see a day where software could fit into that category directly?
Yeah, I think like all the policy levers are taking a bite
different
of a very
bite at the apple.
We have to think about, I think like Cyber Trustmark is a great example of saying, how do you create demand? How do you answer demand?
Mm-hmm.
And how do you communicate? How do you visualize and communicate demand? I think there's secure by design principles that have to do with just getting markets to want to move faster on patching known vulnerabilities, right? Mm-hmm. There's already a patch out there. Like, how do you get them to do that? Again, for us, and we want to emphasize that those continue to be like really important efforts that are really important driving the ecosystem forward. And I think where, you know, ONCD is sitting, at least the technology security director is sitting, is saying, okay, what is that next like hard problem that it is not yet ripe enough for a traditional policy lever?
So you opened up an AI. I can't let you escape without a quick discussion about generative AI and quite honestly, the role it can play here in software development and the like. Any big thoughts you want to share on some of the big questions we're all grappling with? Because I think it is still very early on in terms of what the red, blue, offense, defensive balance could look like. But
yeah, it's a perfect example of we want to win on innovation. We're also aware that if we let this completely
autocratic regimes can win.
Right. It's a perfect example to show the dual use of any emerging technology. I think there's an opportunity for us, and I think this is for both the private and public sectors, to come together and say, how do we, instead of exploiting a fault line in a debate about whether innovation is good or bad or whether national security is good or bad, instead of exploiting a fault line, actually pushing through and say, okay, we are going to figure out how to win on innovation, make sure that winning
on tech.
Which
is in our national security
interests. Yeah, and also make
sure
that it doesn't get weaponized.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I think makes AI really hard is you're dealing with, when you think of that cybersecurity, and oftentimes I'll say that in the AI conversation, like the term security and safety get conflated incorrectly. Mm-hmm. When I think about what security means, the way I define it is the environment causing harm to the system? But what safety means is a system causing harm to the environment. And those require very different solutions, even though they're complementary.
Kind of what the IT/OT community, many went into business preventing natural disaster, Three Mile Isles, versus security. That's actually,
so you have to think about
both
the
sides.
Former is really preventing against kind of the vectors coming into towards the system. And so here, when you think about safety, it's now I'm looking at outputs. And that is a much harder problem because, one, what outputs in what context, right? The context of a military use case is very different than a healthcare use case. But then to make it even more complicated, we're dealing with AI that is stochastic, mm-hmm. meaning like every single time you run a query or you ask the model a question, it's not going to give you the same answer every time. So you have this kind of probabilistic element that makes it like that much more complicated. One of the things that we talk about in our work here is on both sides of the report, right? When you think about the building block side, the use of formal methods becomes very compelling because, again, if you can't test your way out of software, you definitely cannot test your way out of AI, right? Permutations are just way too big to be able to like test and say, hey, is there a hallucination here that I should be worried about?
Yeah.
So what does it mean to bring math proofs to say, I want to ensure a standard of security and or safety, and I want to create literally a math proof that says, yep, this has met mm-hmm. that bar. Like that to me is very compelling. On the second chapter on software understanding, I think AI is going to help us move forward, because if we're saying that the reason software was hard to understand for these last several decades is because it's this very like creative form of human mm-hmm. expression, it turns out we now have a way to understand human expression mm-hmm. through mm-hmm. large language models, and maybe we can use this to actually understand our code better. So I think we're coming back to this research problem, not with the same set of tools, but now with new tools. So I think we wrote this paper absolutely with AI in mind, even though we didn't name it explicitly. But I think it was a perfect test balloon for us to say, how do we meet this moment that the whole world is thinking about and recognize that we need a new way forward?
And the fact that you start with software, it really is a building block. You don't want to build an amazing city on quicksand or fault lines or what have you. And that is the organic unit where you can actually have greatest impact.
And it's also more fun, I think, to re-architect something.
Absolutely.
Is a lot more fun than to have
workarounds.
put the fire out afterwards.
What questions didn't I ask that I should have, Anjana?
One of the things in terms of what's next for us is this is not just an American problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the cyberspace mm-hmm. is not limited to these borders.
Mm-hmm.
And so the next step for us is really bringing back to the building blocks global and really think about how do we get an international coalition to think like this and join us in this effort. And so we are heading to the UK in a short while to meet with members of industry and government and civil society and academia to really share what we've learned and what we're building and bring them along on this journey with us.
Awesome, because the truth is we can't take for granted democratic institutions alone are going to be devoting the time and the money and the effort and the resources to doing this. Anjana, thank you for fighting the good fight. Thank you for all you're doing. Keep running. Endurance is key. I'm telling you, it's everything.
Because
Washington's got a lot of sprinters. We need them, but we need to make sure we get this over the goal line. Yeah. Thank you for everything, and thank you for joining us today.
Me.
Thank you.